We'll turn in your Bibles to Romans 7, if you've not done so already. Going to continue our discussion here as Paul is dealing with this topic of sanctification. Last time together we looked at verses 14 and 15. And it's here in these verses and following where Paul begins to introduce his turmoil. Turmoil that we all as believers should share, at least on this side of eternity. A turmoil that should grow more and more intense as we mature in the faith. Let me read you this note. An interesting comment from the Reformation Study Bible. Paul is actually describing a profound conflict that every Christian finds inherent in his life in Christ. Christ dwells in him, yet sin also dwells in him. Perfect conformity to God's will is at present out of his reach. Salvation has already and not yet dimensions. We are already liberated from the power of sin, but we are not yet free from the presence of sin. And we know from reading Paul's letters, the more mature he became in the faith, the more aware of his sin he became, the more guilt he felt about his sin, the more humbled he felt about his stature. I've mentioned it several times. You know, when Paul, early in his ministry, as he was writing, he said, "I'm the least of the apostles." That is a statement of humility. But then as he matured, he realized, well, I still had myself on a pedestal there. And then he said, "I'm the least of all the saints." As he pondered his sin and wrestled with it. And then as he got even more mature in the faith, he got to the point where he said, "I am the chiefest of all sinners." And the point of that was not to say, "How wretched a man am I," even though we know he considers himself a wretched man. His point was to say, "How great a Savior is our God, because look what he does." And so that's what it should do. As I said, we looked at verses 14 and 15. Let's just read those again as they start this section. "For we know the law is spiritual, but I am of the flesh, sold under sin. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not what I want, but I do the very thing I hate." As we noted before, the lost don't hate their sin. I'm not saying a lost person can't feel guilt, but it's strange things. They feel guilty about the wrong things or for the wrong reasons. It's not a guilt or a detestation of their sin. In addition, you know, he says, "I don't understand my own actions." The lost aren't confused by their actions. Their only desire is to please themselves. Unfortunately, too often for us, we still have that desire to please ourselves. But for the lost person, there's no confusion. There is only one person to please, and that is themselves. They are their own lords. They see no reason to serve another. They don't bow their knee to another. Even if they worship another false deity, it ultimately is an act of self-righteousness. It's because they don't want to bow their knee to the true Lord. And so, unlike the sinner, Paul here tells us he hates his sin. He doesn't want to do it. It bothers him. And so that leads us to verses 16 and 17, where we'll pick up then. Let's read those together. "Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me." Now, he's already told us multiple times in this chapter that the law is good. The argument of antinomianism, Paul being against the law, that's been squelched. Romans 7:7, "What shall we say then, that the law is sin? By no means. Verse 12, so the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. Verse 14, for we know the law is spiritual, but I am of the flesh, sold under sin. So Paul has already gone to great lengths to acknowledge the goodness of the law. It's incapable of being a savior because we can't follow it to perfection, but that didn't make the law bad. The fact that the Jews and even Gentiles in some case were trying to use the law for something it wasn't intended to do didn't make the law bad. It just meant they were misguided. So here in verse 16, he tells us he agrees with the law. It's a bit of a conundrum, though, isn't it? He's not trying to prove his honor and respect for the law by his adherence to it, because he's saying he's failing at that. He doesn't fulfill the law to the extent that he should. Rather, he's demonstrating his honor and respect for the law by his desire to obey it. Whether successful or not, the fact that he has this desire is how we know that he's a believer. It's how we know that his heart has been changed. It's how we know that there's something different about him than there was back when he was just Saul going about pretending. I won't say pretending. He was zealous for God, just the wrong way and with the wrong methods. So he's not saying, you know, I believe the law is good because look how well I follow it. That's what the rich young ruler would say. Paul said, you know, I agree with the law because of how much I hate it when I don't follow it, how much it bothers me. So look at verse 16 again. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. He's covered both sides of it. Look back at verse 15. He says, I do not do what I want. What does he want to do? He wants to obey the good law. But I do the very thing I hate, which is what? He hates to disobey the good law. There's his conundrum. But from either side of the coin, he's in favor of the law. He agrees that it is good. It is useful. Verse 17, then, he gives us the result. We know it's the result. He starts with the word so. These things I've just said, so, as a result, now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. And that some people have struggled over that verse. Paul is not at all trying to make an excuse for his sin. Totally on the contrary. He's not trying to lay the blame at the foot of someone else or something else. He's not saying, I'm not responsible for my sin. Something else is. I can't help it. It's not my fault. He wouldn't call himself wretched a few verses later if his sin were merely the fault of someone else or something else. He wouldn't feel guilt or remorse if it wasn't. Most of us don't walk around feeling guilty for crimes that we don't commit. And so he's not trying to excuse it. You know, there was a, back in his time frame, and it really led to Gnosticism, there was a form of dualism. Dualism can mean many things depending on what you read about. It could be religious, philosophical, whatever. Most common thing that we've probably experienced dualism, you know, that you got the demon on one side and the angel on the other, and we got the good and bad. I read a story of an Indian religious leader one time who talked about a good animal and bad, it was a wolf or something like that, and he's, which the one that wins is the one you feed the most. That's not Christianity, but in Greek dualism, it basically said there's a separation between our soul and our body, and so much so that our bodies sin, but our souls aren't touched by it, so we can do whatever we want. They're totally separate. Well, that's not the case, and that's not what Paul's teaching here. Let me read you this by John Calvin. I think he explains it well. he's commenting on verse 17 here. This is not the pleading of one excusing himself as though he was blameless, as the case is with many triflers who think they have a sufficient defense to cover all their wickedness when they cast the blame on the flesh. But it is a declaration by which he shows how very far he dissented from his own flesh and his spiritual feeling. For the faithful are carried along in their obedience to God with such fervor of spirit that they deny the flesh. This passage also clearly shows that Paul speaks here of none but of the godly, who have been already born again. For as long as man remains like himself, whatsoever he may be, he is justly deemed corrupt. But Paul here denies that he is wholly possessed by sin. Nay, he declares himself to be exempt from its bondage, as though he had said that sin only dwelled in some part of his soul, while with an earnest feeling of heart he strove for and aspired after the righteousness of God, and clearly proved that he had the law of God engraven within him. I know that was kind of lengthy, but basically what he's saying there is, only a believer could make these comments. Only a believer could acknowledge his sinful behavior as such and to test it in the very fiber of his being, even while it is being committed. And so, Paul, again, he's not making an excuse here. He's rather pointing out, my spirit and soul have been redeemed, but I'm still in this body of flesh for the time being. Now, as we talked about last time, that will end. We'll lose the body of flesh and we'll get a new body and we'll know what it really means to worship someday. You know, all of us, I'm sure at some point in time, hopefully not as adults, more so as children, but all of us have probably wondered, man, eternity might get boring. Just doing the same thing over and over again, you know. Worship Christ, worship Christ, worship Christ. You know, after 5-10 million years, that would get old, wouldn't it? In these bodies, it would. Not in those perfected bodies. And so, that's what Paul's pointing out. Now, the word I is important in this text. Look back a few verses into chapter 6. Look at chapter 6, verse 6. We know that our old self was crucified with him in order that the body of sin, or flesh, he'll use that term interchangeably, might be brought to nothing so that we would no longer be enslaved to sin. We spent a lot of time in chapter 6 talking about self being crucified, and we died with Christ. We're new creatures. We're just still in an old vessel. MacArthur says this, although the old self is dead, sin retains a foothold in our temporal flesh or our unredeemed humanness with its corrupted desires. The believer does not have two competing natures, the old and the new, but one new nature that is still incarcerated in unredeemed flesh. And there's a big difference there. So that's, he's basically saying that dualism doesn't exist. You have one nature. Sin still dwells within your flesh, within your mortal bodies, but your desire is towards God and towards the law and towards righteousness. The more mature we get, the more we are crucifying the flesh or mortifying the flesh, denying those things. So, in chapter 7 and 8 specifically, he uses I most of the time to refer to his new inner self. And then he'll talk about the flesh separately from that. So, as MacArthur put it there, his new self is still incarcerated in unredeemed flesh, but it's new nonetheless. It's changed. It's different. And that's how he can say, I do not do what I want, or how he can say, I agree with the law. If he was not changed, he couldn't say that. Romans 3, he told us what the unregenerate is like. There's no desire to do righteousness. They don't have a care because they don't fear God. The only reason one obeys God is because they fear him, because they understand him to be God. And the one to be obeyed. And the lost don't share that. So look at verse 17 again. He says, so now it is no longer I, my new inner self, who do it, but sin that dwells within me, in the flesh, in the vessel that I'm still incarcerated in. So at this stage, though, we really need to bring in verse 18 right away. Look what he says there. For I know that nothing good dwells in me. A lot of people struggle with that. You know, they say, a believer, well, the Holy Spirit dwells in you. Jesus Christ dwells in you. That's not what he's saying. When we teach little children that Jesus lives in them, what do we say? He's in where? Your heart. In your new self, your new inner being. We wouldn't say that Jesus Christ is in our flesh, in our mortal bodies. And so he differentiates it there. Look at verse 17. So it's no longer I, the new me, who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. He's separating the two. So dwelling within me, he's talking about the flesh. When he's using that word I there, he's clearly talking about the new self. So he immediately clarifies what he meant in verse 17 when he said sin dwells within me. He's not, again, speaking of that new inner self or our soul. That record has been cleaned. All sins, past, present, and future, have been paid for at the foot of the cross. If we had to pay for them again, that's double jeopardy. That would not make God just. He would be unjust if he did that. He'd be like a human ruler or leader at that point. And so my new inner self is clean. It's righteous. Not only has the sin record been expunged, but righteousness, perfect righteousness, complete fulfillment of the law has been imputed into my account. There was a debit and a credit that took place. Paul even uses accounting terms when he talks about that. So my new inner self, God looks at it and thinks, well, there's righteous Scott. I know you guys don't look at me that way. But thankfully, God looks at me that way. But the flesh, there's still this battle going on, this conundrum that we talked about. So speaking of the flesh here, the mortal body, the sin is still there, he says in verse 17. And we all know it. We all battle with it. Again, I think most of us would look at this passage and not be encouraged by the fact that Paul is a sinner. Not, you know, shame on him for his sin. But we'd be encouraged by the fact that, well, we're not the only ones. I hope when you lay your head on your pillow at night that you feel horrible about your sin. But we can feel guilty about sin and still know the peace that passes understanding. We can have the desire to be more and more Christ-like in this earth while still knowing that, as Dale said earlier, no man can pluck us out. We can't even wiggle ourselves out of his hand. But the struggle is real. The sin is still there. It's there, but it's different because it's because of the time frame in his life. Notice he says there, so now it is no longer I who do it. He's contrasting his present with his past. It wasn't strange that sin was there before. He was nothing but sin. Now it is strange. Now it's no longer I. Now it's no longer the inner self, the new me. Now it's the body of sin that I'm still trapped in. But the new me is permanently new. It is permanently alive. It is permanently changed, regenerated. So, as I stated earlier, it's now a conundrum, but it wasn't before. He's trying to reconcile for them that sin still dwells in him, that is, in his flesh, but it's not affecting the justification that he's already taken or described in earlier chapters. Now, Let's jump back to verse 18. Notice there he says, I know that nothing good dwells in me. Again, he's acknowledging his weakness in the flesh. He's acknowledging his culpability. He is not making an excuse that I can't be punished. It's not me. It's sin that's in me. Sin's responsible. Punish sin. Can't punish me. I'm off the hook. Nothing good dwells in me. There's nothing in Paul, in spite of all of his missionary endeavors, in spite of all of the things that he suffered for the sake of Christ, in spite of all the letters or books of the Bible that he wrote, there's nothing in Paul that was worth saving. Yet, God set his affection on Paul and saved him anyway. He's really differentiating a man-centered or works-based religion from the religion that he talked about in chapters 3, 4, and 5, a justification or a righteousness that comes from outside of us. There's nothing good in him. There wasn't anything good in him. His old self, the inner man, wasn't good either. But it's been changed, and so he's acknowledging still the flesh in that body. He's acknowledging his culpability. He's acknowledging that while God was the cause and the source of his justification, God will be the cause and the source for his sanctification. Now, he's going to elaborate on that in the second part of verse 18. And when we say cause and the source for his sanctification, it's not that we can just sit back and do nothing. Paul tells us to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. But I cannot sanctify myself without the power of the Spirit. It's God working through me to will and to do his good pleasure. So, you know, if you find yourself in a state where I don't want to do right, or I don't want to work out my salvation, that's where Peter comes in and says, you better go check your calling and your election. Because the Christian has that desire. The Christian goes through this struggle. The Christian wants to do right even when he's not doing right. So look at the second part of verse 18 as he's elaborating on this. He says, for I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. Now, that Greek word translated as ability to carry it out, that's one word that translates that whole phrase. It's an interesting one. The Greek word is katergadzomai. You can see how that one word could translate into multiple English words. But here's what it means. It means to bring about a result by doing something, to achieve, accomplish, do, or to cause a state or condition, to bring about, to produce, create. The NASB actually is a more accurate or more literal translation. Here's what NASB... ESV says, for I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. NASB says this, the willing is present in me, but the doing of good is not. The willing, the desire is there, but the doing is not present. It's a more accurate translation. So listen to verses 18 and 19 together then. For the willing is present in me, but the doing of good is not. For the good I want, I do not do, but I practice the very evil that I do not want. I mean, if I asked for a show of hands and said, how many of you want to do evil? None of you would raise your hands. Even if you were a lost person sitting in here, you know the environment you're in, so you're not going to raise your hand anyway. But those of you who are children of God don't want to do evil. And yet, if you're like me, you've probably done evil already today. You've missed the mark somewhere. If you're a child of God, you want to please him. You want to do good. You want to hit the mark. If you're a child of God, you want to hear those words, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And yet, on some days, as you sit there and ponder in your mind, this is why we have a moment of silent prayer when we do communion. You need to be alone with God, with your thoughts and your sin. And that is perhaps the most important part of communion, in my opinion, because you can swallow a wafer and drink some juice, and that's not going to do anything for you. The whole point of that exercise is for us to remember what he's done, and then to evaluate ourselves in light of that. If he's done this, how could I have done those things that I've done this week or this month? And so, if you're a child of God, your desire is to hear those words, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." And yet, the more mature you become, doesn't it seem the farther away that could be? I mean, good and faithful servant, the expectation should be getting higher and higher, it seems, and yet we become more and more aware of our sin, more burdened by our sin. Thankfully, the conforming is something that's done to us, not something that we do. When he says we're being conformed to his image, the idea there is being pressed into a mold. And it can be a painful process sometimes, but we are being conformed. Again, just like at salvation, we don't check our minds or our wills at the door in our sanctification. But if you are relying on yourself for your sanctification, you're going to struggle. But if you try to live each day asking for your daily bread, asking for the Lord to not lead you into temptation, to deliver you from evil, to protect you from that, to give you the help that you need, and you live your life each day with the knowledge that it's only by his grace that you can continue to be pressed into that mold, then it will affect your behavior. It'll affect your desires, your mind, your will. And so that's what Paul's getting at here. Look at, I thought this was interesting. Why don't you see how carefully Paul is laying out the evidence with this difficult topic. We're going to look at some words here. Start back at verse 15. Not the words you would expect us to be looking at. Look at the first word in verse 15. For. And then you get to verse 16. He says now. Because he's building on what he just said. Verse 17. So. Because he's building on what he just said. Verse 18. For. And then later on in the verse, four. Verse 19, four. And finally it gets to verse 20. Now, the end result. Verse 19 then, that we just read, for the good that I want, I do not do, but I practice the very evil that I do not want. It's just showing us both sides of the same coin. Look at it again. For I do not do the good I want, I'm reading from the ESV here, for I do not do the good I want. That's a sin of omission, or sins of omission. But the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing. Sins of commission. In verse 20 then, he's basically reiterating the point he made in verse 17. Look at verse 20 again. Now if I do not do what I want, it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. And again, he's not making an excuse. He's not passing the buck or the blame. I'll remind you again the importance of that word I. It's no longer I, the inner man, the inner self who's doing it. He's not being possessed by some other being that's causing him to sin or do these wicked things. He's saying that it's no longer a desire of his inner man. His flesh is weak sometimes. He still stumbles. But it's not his desire. Let me read you a couple of commentaries talking about that verse there. John Gill said this. Again, speaking of verse 20. The same conclusion is formed here as in Romans 7:17, not with any view to excuse himself from blame and sinning, but to trace the lusts of his heart and the sins of his life to the source and the fountain of them, the corruption of his nature. and to ascribe them to the proper cause of them, which was not the law of God, nor the new man, but the sin that dwelt in him. I think that was pretty succinct. Frederick Godet said this: it's not to be thought that Paul wishes to exculpate himself in the least when he says it's not I who do it, but sin. On the contrary, he wishes to make the miserable state of bondage to which he is reduced the more palpable. He is not master even of his own house. There he finds a tyrant who forces him to act in opposition to his better wishes. What humiliation, what misery. It is the state of sin regarded from its painful rather than from its culpable point of view. Finally, William E. Vine says this: this verse provides no ground of excuse on the part of anyone for sinning, as if it was not the person who did it, but the responsibility lay upon an inward principle. That is not the apostle's meaning at all. Moreover, it runs contrary to his whole line of argument, which represents the believer as in a struggle under the realization of the sinfulness of sin as evoked by the law and as one who disapproves of the act. Again, if he were really making an excuse to remove his culpability, he wouldn't have been grieved by his sin. He wouldn't feel guilty by his sin. We have no reason to feel guilty, as we said before, about a crime we didn't commit. You turn the news on today, you're going to see crimes all over the place. I don't feel guilty for any of them because I wasn't the one committing those crimes. Paul wouldn't feel that guilt, that burden. He wouldn't be grieved if he was saying, it's not me, somebody else, something I can't control, it's outside of me. No, it's very much inside of him. It's very much his decision when he sins to do so, and yet his new self, his inner self, just doesn't want to do that. All of us understand that sense of struggle. Let me read you a quote from John MacArthur here. After salvation, sin, like a deposed and exiled ruler, no longer reigns in a person's life, but it manages to survive. We spent a lot of time talking about that in chapter 6 and sin reigning. It no longer resides in the innermost self because it's been crucified, it's been put to death, but finds its residual dwelling in his flesh, in the unredeemed humanness that remains until a believer meets the Lord at the rapture or at death. Galatians 5:17 says, "For the flesh sets its desire against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh." Paul further explained to the Galatians, "For these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please." In this life, Christians are somewhat like an unskilled artist who beholds a beautiful scene that he wants to paint, but his lack of talent prevents him from doing the scene justice. The fault is not in the scene or in the canvas, the brushes or the paint, but in the painter. And that is why we need to ask the master painter, Jesus Christ, to place his hand over ours in order to paint the strokes that, independent of him, we could never produce. Jesus said, "Apart from me, you can do nothing," John 15:5. The only way we can live victoriously is to walk by Christ's own spirit and in his power in order not to carry out the desire of the flesh. So, as we begin to wrap up today, I want to go back and read verses 14 through 20 in their entirety. Listen to the whole picture he's painting here. "For we know the law is spiritual, but I am of the flesh, sold under sin. For I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want, is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. I want you, I wanted to read that together for us to kind of get the big picture, but I also want us to look at that, those verses then, and see he's really making his argument twice. No doubt for emphasis, no doubt for clarity. Look at verse 14. He says, I am of the flesh. Then look down at verse 18. Nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh. Now look at verse 15. I do not understand my own actions. Verse 18. The willing is present in me, but the doing of good is not. Here's what I want to do, here's what I do do. Go back up to verse 15. I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. And then jump down to verse 19. For I do not the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep doing. Verse 17. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. And then jump back down to verse 20. Now if I do what I do not want, is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. He's literally almost repeated himself verbatim, trying to get that point across. He's trying to get them to understand this battle is real, but it's temporary. But this battle is something that will be won if you're a child of God. We will persevere. We will be conformed. Reminded us a couple times as we do this, and Dale reminds us every Sunday, he is able to keep us from stumbling. Doesn't always, but he's able. But what else does he say in that verse? He will present us faultless. That part is guaranteed. And so, when we come back next time, we'll begin to look at the last paragraph in this chapter, where he begins to bring this all together, because Paul is not, he's not giving them these thoughts. He's not making this confession to them to leave them on a dour note. He's using this confession as an encouragement for them, that all of us who are still within these mortal bodies, these bodies of flesh, will struggle with sin from time to time. And the guilt, the remorse, the disappointment should be real. The difference is, for the believer, Satan's going to try to accuse us. That's where the guilt comes. Satan comes in and says, oh, look what you're doing. Are you really a Christian? You can't. You're not a child of God. Satan accuses us before God. Oh, look at your servant Job. Look at these servants. Look what they're doing. But we've got an advocate. Christ stands there as our attorney and says, yeah, their debt's been paid. It's clean. So Paul's writing this to encourage them. Again, the position is secure. It will not change. But a Christian who does not, let me say that, a professing Christian who does not care about their sanctification, we have to question whether they're a Christian at all. So that's the whole point he's making in these three chapters here. Just because righteousness that causes salvation comes from outside of you does not mean that you now have a free pass. Remember the question he asked earlier, should we go on sinning? Sin more, grace may abound. You know, grace has got it covered. Do what I want. God forbid, he said, may it never come into being. The believer is somebody who will be changed, and the more mature they become, the more their sin will grieve them. So we'll look at that last paragraph. We're not going to look at verse 21 today, but I just want you to look at the first word. He starts it with the word so, which means he didn't just give us this last section to fill up space. He had a reason for it. He had a point, and we'll look at that next time we're together, Lord willing.